Well, we're back in the book of Genesis, and those of you who have been here for a while know that we've been preaching through the book of Genesis verse by verse, and I am absolutely convinced that you've got to get the book of Genesis right, but the rest of the Bible does not make sense. So the last time I preached in the Sunday morning, we did a different topic, so we're going to back up and have a brief, a little bit of review. Think about it. Genesis, the book of beginnings. In Genesis chapter 1, we saw that God created the heavens and the earth and everything that was in it. And when, after he created it, what did he say about it? It was what? Very good. All right, it was good. And we look at the world today around us and it's like, some things just aren't so good. So then in chapter 3, we saw what went wrong. What happened? We saw Satan tempted the mankind and sin entered into the world and it affected all of creation. That's what went wrong. Well, in chapter 4, then we saw the first murder and we saw examples of people that believed in God and people that didn't believe in God. And there was basically two worldviews developed here where those people that wanted to obey God and those people that didn't. And it continues to this day. In chapter 5, and this is almost 1,500 years have passed to this point. There's some genealogies given there. And then in chapter 6, we get up and we see in chapter 6, verse 5, and God saw the wickedness of man, that it was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And so things have gotten really bad. And God says, okay, I've had enough of this. I've got to judge this. It just, something has to change. But you know what? In verse 8, there was one man, and now I think I have sound. In verse 8, there was one man. His name was Noah. And Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Even though the rest of the human race, except for maybe his family, was all wicked, there was one guy that believed God and he found grace. And so as God decided, I'm going to destroy the earth, and he sends a flood in chapter 8 or in chapter 7 and it destroys everything, and civilization as it was known was gone. So then we got to chapter 8 and
need a different microphone. Do you want me to use this one or?
Okay. All right. So I'm going to be on the pulpit mic. All right. That means I can't wander. Okay. Then in chapter 8, we saw that the water, they were on the ark. How long were they on the ark? Anybody remember? Almost a year. It was about a year that they were on this ark. The waters recede and they get off. And what does Noah do in chapter 8? Verse 20, Noah built an altar, and what did he do? He worshiped God. Think about this. Everything that he knew in this world was destroyed, except this family that was on there, and he still worships God. Well, in verse 22 then, God made a covenant, and it said as long as the earth remains, he wasn't going to destroy the earth again. Well, that brings us up to where we're at now, and we're in chapter 9, verse 1. And it says, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Now, it's interesting here. We see the second word is God. And we talked about this earlier in the book, that in Genesis, we see the use of the word God, which is Elohim. Elohim, the supreme ruler, the creator, the sustainer of life. But in chapter 8, verse 21, just a couple verses before it, we saw the use of the word Lord, Jehovah or Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God. And in Scripture, different names of God are used to indicate different or to emphasize different attributes or characteristics of God. And so in chapter 8, we were seeing the Lord, God had made a covenant with Abraham, and he kept that covenant. In chapter 9, the earth has been destroyed, and this creator God is going to replenish the earth. And so he goes back to using the name Elohim. So it says, and God blessed Noah. Isn't that special? God blessed him. Have any of you ever been blessed by God? And if you don't say you have, I'm going to say you better back up and think a little. God has blessed us in many ways. But he's given Noah a special blessing here. He's brought him through this flood in spite of the wickedness of everybody else. He's blessed him. He's brought him through. And he blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Now, it seems to me in the book of Genesis, we've seen that something really similar to that before, haven't we? And you might want to stick your finger in chapter 1 because we're going to be flipping back and forth between chapter 9 and chapter 1 a number of times. But God created man. And in chapter 1, now I'm losing, I don't see it in my notes. I lost my place. Okay, chapter 1, verse 28 and 27. God created man in his own image, in the image of God created him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them. Okay, God blessed Adam and Eve. Same as he's blessing Noah and his family. And God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful, multiply. And the King James says replenish. It says replenish both in chapter 1 and chapter 9. It's actually would be fill or repopulate would be a better translation. Populate the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over it. God had told Noah and his sons to do it. He told Adam and Eve to do it. And so he's just saying, okay, everything's been wiped out. I want people on this earth. So they're supposed to replenish the earth. This is one thing that God told the human race to do that they have done. But did they do it completely the way God wanted them to? Think about, in a couple of chapters, we're going to get to the Tower of Babel. God had told them to replenish or to fill the earth. But what did mankind do? They wanted to stay together, and they didn't spread out the way God intended for them to. So they partially obeyed. They repopulated, but they didn't fill the earth the way God intended. And we will see that in a couple of weeks. So in verse 1 of chapter 9, we saw that God is saying to propagate the human race. Now let's back up a little. Why is God so intent on having people on this earth? Why did God want people in the first place? What are we here for? God has a plan and a purpose for our lives. And he wants us for fellowship. He wants to have fellowship with us. He wants us to worship him. And he desired that. He could have wiped out the entire human race and been done with it. But he still has a plan and a purpose. And he also gave the human race dominion over the earth. And we'll see that as we get along a little further in this lesson, or in this message. So, the first, according to my title, life is essential, was to reproduce, to populate the earth. Then we move into the second point, and that will be in verse 2. We'll start there. And it says, and the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, and upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea, into their hand are they delivered. What's he talking about here? Remember back in chapter 1 and 2, everything that God made was very good. And there was unity and harmony and creation, and everything got along just great. But remember in chapter 3, something went wrong. Sin came in to the earth and into the human race. And now after the flood, things have changed. It's an entirely new ball game. It says the fear of you. The word there actually means the terror. Animals are going to be terrified of people. The word dread of you, the root word comes from, in Hebrew, comes from the idea of something that's shattered or torn apart, which is actually leading into what he's going to say in the next verse, where you can eat animals. So animals, after the flood, are now going to be afraid of people. Now, if you think back in chapter 1, there were different animals mentioned in the creation account. If you look in chapter 1, let's see, verse 20. And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life and the fowl that fly above the earth. So that's talking about, you know, marine aquatic life and birds. And in verse 21, God created whales and every living creature that moveth, and they were after their kind. So that God created birds, fish, and then we drop down in verse 24, and God had created the living creatures after his kind, cattle, creeping thing, and the beasts of the earth. And if you remember when we talked about cattle, that was more of the animals that were able to be domesticated. The creeping things, that's the little bugs and critters and crawly things that most people don't care for too much. And the beast of the field, that's talking about the wild animals, the animals that aren't able to be domesticated. And so we're back in chapter 9 then. God's saying, okay, these animals are going to be afraid of you. But one thing that's interesting in these verses in chapter 9, it doesn't mention cattle. And a number of the commentators say, you know, there's a reason for that. The animals that we now know of as domesticated animals don't have as much fear of people as the other animals. Now you say, well, why would God make animals afraid of people? There's two reasons. To protect the animals. What do human beings do with animals if they're not afraid of them? They tend to make them extinct. They will kill them, and they will, and sometimes for no good reason, but they will abuse the animals that God's made in the sense that they would hunt them to the point where they no longer existed. And so by making the animals afraid of people, God has in a way preserved that species. But on the other side of the coin, making animals afraid of people also protects people. And so God, in his wisdom, has put that wall or barrier between animals and people. Now, and I know that even domesticated animals, if they aren't around people, aren't real tame, okay? You ever had kittens born or something like that? If those kittens are born and somebody messes with them and they're around them and they're used to people, they'll get along. But if not, they're wild as can be. Or I've had a calf that was born in the pasture before and you don't find it for a week. I mean, that thing is as wild as a deer. You can't hardly chase it down. It's the natural instinct of being afraid of people. That's for preservation of animal life and for the preservation of human life. But in the end of verse 2, it says, and into your hand they are delivered. What's that talking about? Remember back in chapter 1? Who did God give dominion over the animals? Mankind. And in our society, we're getting a lot of confusion about that, that people want to say, oh, people and animals, and they're all equal, and animals have as many rights as people. No, the biblical worldview is that God gave man dominion over the animals. In verse 3, then, we see, every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. King James uses the word meat. The word has changed meaning in the last 400 years. It actually would be food. Every moving thing that liveth shall be food for you, even as the green herb which I've given to you. If you think back in Genesis chapter 1, verse 29, what had God told people? What were they to eat back then? In 1:29, God said, behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, of all the earth, and every tree in which there is the fruit of the tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat or for food. There, God had said at the original creation, you can eat all the plants, except there was one that they weren't supposed to, but they were to eat vegetables. Okay? In verse 30, and every beast of the earth and every fowl of the air and upon everything that creepeth upon the earth wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And so it was. Animals were to eat what? Plants. And so that was the original nutritional system that God had planned. But now in verse 3, things have changed. And God's saying, okay, you can eat meat. Does he say you have to eat meat? No, he's not saying you have to eat meat. But he's saying you can eat meat. Now why? What changed? Why? If vegetables were good enough before, why is God saying, okay, now you can eat meat? Is God upset at the animals? He's mad at the animals and he's going to punish them or something? No, I don't think so. You see, what happened after the flood? There was you've heard the word climate change? There was very serious climate change. Before the flood, if there was a water canopy around the earth and it was like a greenhouse effect and it was a constant spring-like environment and everything was green and lush, and remember it didn't rain and the moisture just came up from the ground, the growing conditions for those plants were extremely different than the conditions of the plants after the flood. And you say, well, how do you know that? Well, just in a very simplistic way, as a farmer, the growing conditions of a year change the nutritional value of plants. And there's actually a whole industry where they'll take plants that are going to be fed to animals, and they'll evaluate those, and they'll measure the protein, and then, you know, and there's different kinds of proteins that digest at different rates, and they'll measure the fiber, and, you know, there's digestible fiber and undigestible fiber, and they'll figure this all up and say, okay, this is exactly what your animal should eat to have a properly balanced meal. Now, we don't do that with people. Probably should, but the point being that different growing seasons, if you get a really cloudy, wet year, the protein level is going to be significantly different than if you get a very hot, dry year. And so the nutritional value in these plants have changed as a result of the climate change that occurred after the flood. And God is saying, okay, to get a little more protein in your diet, at least this is my assessment, to get a little more protein in your diet, you know, you can eat animals. He's not saying you have to eat animals. And at this time, there's no restrictions on which animals. Now, later, once the law is given, there are animals that are clean and unclean animals, and God gave those guidelines basically to protect the health of the people, because the unclean animals would carry disease, or they may not, harder to get properly cooked and different things. But God had this all figured out, and he knew. But at this point, he's saying, okay, you can eat meat now if you want. Not saying you have to, but it's an option. Isn't it amazing the variety of things that as humans we can eat? I mean, you can eat raw vegetables, and you can eat cooked vegetables, and you can eat meat, and you can eat dry things like rice, which I don't like rice. If I had to eat rice every day, I wouldn't go for that. But anyway, and you can eat chocolate, and you can put spices on your food, and pepper, and salt, and all these different things. And the way God has created our body as human beings, our body is able to process that, and we get value out of that. Isn't it a miracle that you can do that? I mean, just think about this. Suppose you had to eat rice every day, three meals a day. Or suppose you had to eat chocolate every day, three meals a day. You know, you'd get tired of it after a while. But God has created us in a way, and he's provided quite a variety of things. It's a miracle the way God has created us. But anyway, God has expanded the human diet and says, okay, you can now eat meat if you want to. In Romans chapter 14, and I understand the context there is talking about eating meat that was offered to idols, but the Apostle Paul says, he makes mention that some eat meat and some can eat meat, and they have a conviction, you know, against eating meat. In the New Testament, the consumption of meat was also condoned by God. It's not a problem. And you may choose not to, and that's fine. But that is an option for us. I'm going to talk just a little bit about food. And now I'm really going to step in it. And a really wise preacher wouldn't go here. Okay? Now, when the preacher gets up in the pulpit and he talks about cigarettes, or he talks about alcohol, or he talks about immorality, and he talks about a whole list of things where, man, everybody back here, go, preacher, go, yeah, we're with you. But I recently read a book called Respectable Sins. And there are those things as Christians where, well, it's probably not right, but I don't really want to go there. You know, because it affects me. So here it goes. I'll probably be fired after this. But I really feel that I need to say this. You know, as a believer, God has given us a body. And it's our responsibility to maintain that body. You know, and I understand that people have different genetic makeups, and there's different medical conditions that may affect different people, and different people process food at a different rate. I mean, I'm very inefficient if I was a cow in feed conversion. I mean, I can eat, and it doesn't bother me. So, and I understand there are differences with different people. But we are responsible for moderation and eating in a way that is healthy. It's basically common sense and balance. And I know I'm as guilty as anybody else. When I'm stressed, I eat. If I'm working on a sermon and I can find anything to eat, I don't care, you know, chips, pretzels, nuts, anything that I can get. I mean, when I'm stressed, I'm just shoving it in. That's probably not the biblical mandate for how a person should act. And I want to encourage you. God has given you a body. And he expects you to maintain that in the best way possible to bring glory to him. You know, I know there's a lot of different theories out there on food and different things. And, you know, there's this diet where you eat all protein and this diet where you eat all carbohydrates. And common sense is take the balance, you know. And salt, you know, I know a guy that he did not eat any salt. You actually need a certain amount of salt. If you don't have enough salt, your nervous system doesn't work properly. But if you dump salt on by the shovelful, that's going to make your problems down the road. So just in common sense, use moderation in the things you eat. Do it in a way that preserves your body in the best way that you can please the Lord. Moderation is the key. All right, back to verse 4. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat. What's he saying here? Okay, don't eat blood. In Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11, it talks about the life is in the blood. Do you ever think about how miraculous your body is created with the blood? You have between 5 and 6 quarts of blood in your body. And if that leaks out, you're not going to last too long. And that blood's made up with red blood cells that carries oxygen and different things to all the parts of your body. And within a minute, that blood makes a complete cycle in your body. And there's white blood cells that help you to heal, and they fight off and invaders. And then another thing that's really amazing is that your blood will clot. Did you think about that? You cut yourself and you should bleed to death, right? Except for the fact that God has made you that blood will clot. Your blood is naturally liquid. And most liquids, if you want them to become solid, there has to be temperature change. But your body, because of a lot of different chemical processes and stuff that happen, that blood turns into a semi-solid so that you don't bleed to death. The life is in the blood. In World War II, they learned a lot about the life being in the blood. They learned about blood transfusions and plasma transfusions, and they were able to save a lot of soldiers' lives. But the thing that they learned of how important it was to get that blood into wounded soldiers. Now think back 100 years or so before that, or even before that, George Washington. Tradition says that he died because they left blood out of him. See, the thinking back then was, if you have bad blood in you, we've got to poke a hole in you and let some of it out, and that'll get rid of the disease. And we've learned now that, no, you need your blood. And so things have changed. We've learned a lot about blood. Now, what happens? It's talking here about, well, the life is in the blood. You shouldn't eat raw meat. When you cook meat, it changes the composition of the blood. And by the way, blood also carries or can carry various diseases. There's at least a half a dozen serious diseases that are carried by the blood. You've seen in basketball or something where somebody gets injured and they pull them out of the game because they're bleeding. They don't want that blood getting on other people because it could be disease be transferred. So God's saying, don't eat the blood. Now, take this a little further. There are groups around that say, well, you know, that if that's the case, then blood transfusions aren't right. The Jehovah's Witnesses teach that it's improper to take in the blood of somebody else in your body. Well, that's a little different. When you take in a blood transfusion or a plasma transfusion, you are taking in blood that's going to function and act like blood. If you eat blood, you drink blood, that blood is digested by your body and it's changed into something different. So that's an entirely different thing. So blood transfusions are not prohibited by Scripture, as some would teach. All right, we better move on. I can't camp there any longer or we won't get done. So God's saying, okay, don't eat the blood. And a lot of that is for protection and that the life is in the blood. Oh, by the way, what did Jesus shed when he died on the cross? His blood. His life was given. He shed his blood. All right, move on. Verse 5. And surely your blood of your lives will I require at the hand of every beast. Will I require it at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. Okay, now we're moving in to a protection of human life. Think about it. In our world, in our society today, human life in a lot of places is not valued at all. You can look at what the radical Muslims, Islamists are doing in parts of the world. I mean, they think nothing of taking a human life. You think of what happened in Las Vegas, and there was a guy with some sort of issues. You know, he kills 50-some people. And people, oh, that's terrible, that's terrible. But do you realize on the same weekend, there was just about exactly the same number of people killed in the city of Chicago? And murdered, and nobody says anything about that. Human life is not valued by our society. And God says, hey, but it should be. And we'll get to it in a little bit. In the end of verse 6, it says, because in the image of God we are made. That's why the human life is different than animal life. So back here in verse 5, God is going to require a reckoning. It says, for any beast that kills a person, God's going to require that animal be killed. The idea here of shedding of blood, that's not just they bleed to death. That is killing them in any way. The shedding of blood is a Hebrew idiom that speaks of in any way that a person kills another person. So God's saying, if an animal kills a person, then that animal's life should be terminated. Now, that's not necessarily the way secular culture views this. I mean, we've got animals and we got people and we got animals and this is their territory. And if we go in there, you know, we're violating their territory and we deserve it if we get killed. I'm going to read a little story for you. It's out of the Genesis account book, which is from the Creation Ministries that was here a couple of months ago. George Thomas Wainwright, 32, suffered fatal injuries Saturday when he was bitten by a 10-foot great white shark during a solo dive off the coast of Rottnest Island in Western Australia. In an interview, an activist, and they give his name, Blake Johnson, said that the killing of the shark would be unacceptable and must be ended at once in order to preserve the international conventions and the rights of animals to live. He said, echoing the sentiments of other activists in that country, that a shark attack in Australia is extremely rare, and that the idea that it's a shark's fault isn't even close to reality. We have encroached on marine life for decades, and we should not react in this way. We caused it. The shark did nothing wrong, and we're going to kill it because it killed, because we were in its territory. And we hear that type of thing over and over and over, and it, you know, it sort of sounds good. But let's go back to the biblical worldview. Who did God give dominion? God gave man dominion over the earth and over animals. Now, and the idea of dominion is that we're to manage it for God, and that doesn't mean that we abuse it or take advantage of it or just misuse it for our enjoyment or pleasure. But it also does mean that human life is above animal life, and we need to respect that life of people more than we respect the life of animals. Think about it. You can go to jail for killing a snail or something that's an endangered species, but a baby can be aborted. Is there something wrong with this picture? Anyway, God is saying, if an animal takes a human life, it should be, that should be the end of the animal. And then also in verse 5, if a person takes another human life, and this is talking about in an intentional way. I mean, I understand that there's car accidents and, you know, things like that happen that are not intentional. But this is talking about an intentional thing, you know, like the Cain and Abel type thing. God says that, verse 6, that whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Oh, that's pretty tough. Well, who's supposed to do this shedding of the blood, the second hand? Are we playing the Hatfields and McCoys here and we're going out, okay, you killed this person and I'm going after you? No, this is actually a principle where God is establishing human government. You see, before this, there was no organized government. And at this point, as Pastor preached a couple weeks ago on dispensations, we're moving into the dispensation of human government. And so God is establishing the idea that there needs to be law. There needs to be government that administrates this law. And not just in the area of murder, but there also would then follow that there needs to be law in other areas that could possibly lead to murder. You know, let's say somebody's taking your stuff and you don't like it. Okay? And you get mad enough after a while that you're going to kill them because they're taking your stuff. So, and by extension, not only is God saying, okay, there needs to be human government that punishes murder, but there needs to be other laws that lay that foundation where human beings aren't going to get pushed to the point where they feel that they should take a human life. So in verse 6, whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Now some people say, you know, Dave, oh, but this is the law. This is under the law, and we're not under law. We're under grace, right? Anybody agree with me there? Trick question. This isn't under the law. Where are we at? We're 1,000 years before the law was given to Moses. This is a part of the Noahic covenant that God gave to Noah and his sons and his family as they were getting off the ark, and this was the general guidelines that God was giving them. This is how society needs to function, and that has never been pulled back. Any part of this has never been rescinded by Scripture. In Romans chapter 13, I believe it is, it talks about how that the government does not bear the sword in vain. The government has the right to punish criminals, and including in the area of capital punishment. But, you know, even the Jewish rabbis taught that the Gentiles were not under the law, per se, the Mosaic law, but they taught that the Gentiles were under this law that was given by God to Noah. These general rules about not killing people, allowed to eat animals, not drinking blood. That the Jewish rabbi said, even though you're not Jews, you still have to obey that part. And I believe that it still applies to the human race today. Okay, so then we get to the last part of verse 6, and it says, for in the image of God made he man. Remember, we saw this back in chapter 1, verse 27. God made male and female. In verse 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. We're made in the image of God. See, people are different than animals. We're made in the image of God. What does that mean? You know, there's animal life that, yeah, it's alive, but it's different than there's plant life that's really basic, and then there's animal life that's a little more complex. But what sets humans apart from animals? We're made in the image of God. You see, as humans, we can reason. We can think. We can love. We have a will. We have discernment. We have a moral conscience. At least people used to have a moral conscience. We can communicate with each other. These are characteristics and attributes of God that have come to individuals, to people, that aren't shared by animals. You know, animals do things a lot of times by habit. But people can be logical. Right now, we got a problem. We got squirrels getting in our attic. Okay? And these squirrels are really getting smart. Okay, I've got a box trap up here and I'm trying to catch them. And they figured out that I put feed in that trap. But they've never set the trap off. They think I'm just feeding them. Somehow they figured out how to get the food out of the trap without setting it off. And an animal will learn things like that for survival. But that squirrel's not going to be smart enough to say, you know, if I take this acorn out here and I plant it in the ground, in 30 years, I'm going to have acorns for my little great-great-great-grand squirrels that come along down the road. You see, animals don't think that way. They don't process things the way human beings do. God has created us. We're the pinnacle of God's creation. We're created in his image and for the purpose of fellowship and for worshiping him. And that's why human life is special. Human life is sacred at all spectrums of the thing, from the cradle to the grave. Human life is important to God. Let's go back then in chapter 9, and we'll finish up here. In chapter 9, verse 7, and you, be ye fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth, and multiply therein. He's just coming back to what he said in verse 9. He's saying, okay, fill this place up. You know, I want people, and I want lots of people. And he had a plan, and he had a purpose for putting people on this earth. And you know, God has a plan and a purpose for each of us being here. And he wants to have a relationship with us. You think about it, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. I talked about, you know, how the body can digest different food and how the blood works. And God has made us. And he's made us in his image. And he wants to have a relationship with you. And we talked about how that sin came into the world and messed everything up that was so good. And that sin that you inherit, that characteristic of that bent to, as a sinner, and you also do it by choice. That sin has broken that relationship that we could have with God. And the only way to fix that is through accepting Jesus Christ, God's Son. He came and shed his blood where the life was. He gave that as a substitute for our sin. So I want to challenge you, encourage you. You're here this morning. You've never had that relationship with Jesus Christ. I encourage you to talk to one of the pastors or just there in your seat. Ask the Lord to forgive you and make him part of your life. And if you're here as a believer this morning, I want to encourage you to think about just how miraculously God has made you. I mean, to think that you could evolve from swamp gas into all the things that your body is able to do? No, I don't think that's a possibility. God has created you, and he's created you for the purpose of serving him, and encourage you to do that in the best way possible. Let's close in a word of prayer.